Welcome to another Salvation by Grace message from Grace Christian Assembly in Smyrna, Tennessee. We are currently engaged in a verse-by-verse Bible study of the Gospel of Matthew. Now, let's join the congregation of GCA and our teaching pastor, Jim McLarty.
Well, I'm glad to see you all this morning. Hope everybody had a good holiday. Now that has all happened. That has all come and gone. I hope you had a good New Year's Eve. We had a wonderful time here. Had lots of fun and food and games and fellowship and just thoroughly enjoyable evening. Micah, who kind of spearheaded that, said, let's make this an annual thing. So start planning now. You already know where you're going to be next New Year's Eve. Should Jesus tarry, we'll be here. Plan A, next year we all gather in heaven. But plan B, New Year's Eve at GCA. So we hope you can make it. Turn to Matthew chapter 8. We are continuing in our verse-by-verse exposition of the Gospel of Matthew. And this entire section of Matthew's account is a list, a recounting of Jesus' miracles. And as I said last week, I don't think it's any mistake that Matthew placed this list of miracles where he did, right on the heels of the Sermon on the Mount, because the Sermon on the Mount was Jesus proclaiming his authority. The Sermon on the Mount was Jesus establishing himself as the newer, better, higher lawgiver, the superior to Moses. And at the very end of chapter 7, everybody marveled at him, starting at verse 28. The result was that when Jesus had finished these words, the multitude were amazed at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one having authority and not as their scribes. So they all caught the sense of Jesus' authority. Jesus had a sense about him that whatever he said was true and was to be believed. Jesus continually placed himself at the center of the religious universe and said, whatever you think of me determines your entire eternity. As far as Jesus was concerned, he never had the slightest hint, the slightest blush that anything he said was presumptive or egocentric or not to be believed. He knew who he was, he knew why he was here, he knew what he came to do, and he was revealing the truth of God. He spoke about heaven as if it was his living room. He talked about God as his Father, and he came to reveal truths that human beings were never going to know any other way except if Jesus came to the planet and told us these things. To not believe him, as we saw last week, was evil. To believe him is the only proper response. Any other response where you get your opinion involved, or you get your ego or pride involved, or you become the arbiter of truth, or you decide what's right or what's wrong where Jesus is concerned, any place where you think it's up to you to decide whether he's telling the truth or not is evil. Because he is the truth. Because he is the very embodiment of the truth. Because he is the Word, the incarnate Word come to the planet. And so every word that he spoke was not only true, but every word he spoke were the very words of God. To not believe God is evil. How many times have I said this now? And so to believe Christ is the only reasonable response. But human beings are not reasonable. Human beings are fallen and depraved and willful and sinful and egocentric and prideful, and they want to be the arbiters of truth. They want to decide what's right and what's wrong, and that's been going on ever since the Garden of Eden. If you eat of this tree, you'll decide for yourself what's right, what's wrong, what's good, what's evil. And human beings have been doing it ever since. To this very day, people are still arguing about whether or not you should believe Jesus. Not just believe in Jesus, not just believe about Jesus, but believe Jesus. If Jesus says, that marriage is one man and one woman? Are you supposed to believe that? Well, no, the world says no, we'll decide for ourselves. If Jesus talks about the sanctity of human life, are we supposed to believe him? Well, yes, but human beings don't. No, they'll decide for themselves. They'll decide what they want to do with their own body and their own babies, and they'll decide. We have a long, long history of human beings deciding for themselves whether or not they will believe the things that Jesus says. But Jesus didn't just come to the planet and say stuff. I've come to the planet and said stuff. Todd has come to the planet and said stuff. Jamie's come to the planet and said stuff. What's the difference between what I say, or what Leon says, or what Conrad says, and what Jesus says? What's the difference? Well, the difference is Jesus backed it up with evidence. I got no evidence. All I can do is appeal to your logic. Or appeal to my likability and boyish good looks. I can only appeal to trying to convince you, but Jesus actually had evidence. Not only did he declare things, but then he did things that no human being can do. And that's why Matthew created this juxtaposition that goes right from Jesus said all this stuff to Jesus did all this stuff. Because the things he did prove that the things he said are true. He exercised authority, a kind of authority that no human being has. He didn't just speak with authority, but then he went out and took authority over everything. The three particular miracles that we're going to look at this morning show that he has authority over sickness. He's going to heal Peter's mother-in-law. Then he's going to prove that he has authority over nature. And that's the story of him in a boat in a storm, and he calms the storm with just a word, because he's in charge of nature. And then Matthew writes that he's in charge of the demonic realm, and not just puny little demons. No, a legion of demons that worship him and call him Son of God and ask him, what are you doing here? Have you come to punish us before our time? They recognize him as the judge. They recognize him as the authority. So Matthew is purposefully telling us that Jesus exercised authority over every realm of the creation. Ever since the fall of men, there's been sickness, because the wages of sin is sickness and death. That's why our congregation is currently decimated by the current virus flu going around. It's not because of just virus, it's because of sin. It's because fallen human beings get old, get sick, and die, and that is all evidence, according to Paul, that we're all sinners. The evidence he offers for the universality of sinfulness is the fact that all human beings die. If you want to argue that you're not sinful, just don't die, and we'll all believe you. But people get old, get sick, die, because human beings are sinful. That's been going on ever since the fall. So when Jesus comes to the planet, one of the things that Isaiah said he would do was in his own body take our sicknesses. And then while he was on the planet, he walked around exercising authority over sickness. Now, the best we can do is maybe take a pill, get a potion, find something we can take that will alleviate the symptoms. Jesus got rid of things like viruses. Now, think about this. Viruses and germs obeyed his command. That's pretty authoritative. I don't have that kind of authority. Do you, Todd? Not a bit. Can you yell at viruses loud enough to get them to go, okay, we're leaving? No, you just don't. One of the saddest demonstrations of that in human life is watching people, watching their loved ones suffer with sickness. It's heartbreaking. You know, in my job, I get that phone call. Somebody's sick. Can you pray for them? Can you come to the hospital? Is there anything we can do? Can you? And it's just heart-wrenching to watch people, especially if it's a parent and a sick child. Every parent in the room will tell you that they would make that bargain immediately with God. Take the sickness from my baby and give it to me. I'll take the pain, anything, because it's just heart-wrenching to watch people you love go through sickness, go through illness. But that's the human condition, and that's why one of the things that Jesus took authority over was sickness, because he has authority over everything. So, Luke, it's a windy day out. It's not terribly windy right now. It's going to get colder. As the day progresses today, it's going to get colder. What'd you say, by tonight, 15, something like that?
It'll be down to like 3 come midweek, but it just gets colder.
By midweek 3, Wednesday night. Hey, by the way, we'll be here Wednesday night.
See you there.
See you there. Temperature of 3. So, Luke, can you go out and yell at the weather and make it change?
No.
Do you have any authority over the wind? Can you go out there and threaten the wind so that it'll do your bidding? No. If you did, we would all decide you were a lunatic. And we'd be right, especially if you believed it. If you were like, I make the weather, we'd be like, you get to go to a box somewhere. And we'll look at you through a hole in the door. We have a jacket for you. Yeah, because we know that nobody has any control of the weather. So what does Jesus do? Controls the weather to show that he's in control. Now, one facet of human life where we obviously just don't seem to have any control at all is against the demonic realm, against genuine evil. In the book of Acts, we read about a couple of amateur Jewish exorcists who attempted to cast out demons by the name of Jesus and the name of Paul. And the demons said to them, Jesus we know, Paul we know, but who are you? And the demoniac leapt on them, tore them, ripped their clothes off, ripped their skin, and they ran out naked and screaming. Because human beings don't have any real authority over the demonic realm. So what does Jesus do? He takes authority over the demonic realm because he's proving category by category, dangerous thing by dangerous thing, problem for humans by problem for humans. He keeps demonstrating that he has all the authority. And if that is true, if he has authority over demons, if he has authority over sickness, if he has authority over nature, then when he speaks, you ought to listen. You ought to pay attention, because you don't know anybody who has that kind of authority. And he does. So one of the great contrasts for Matthew is that he describes Jesus' authority and then describes the way that nature obeys him, the way that sickness obeys him, the way that demons cry out and obey him, even have to ask him before they can inhabit pigs. Because he has that kind of authority. So pigs obey him, and demons obey him, and the wind obeys him, and water obeys him. Sickness obeys him. Viruses, germs obey him. It's only humans who refuse to obey him. Now, there is, of course, this philosophy in much of religion, and especially in Christianity. There is this philosophy that says human beings have a free will. I don't necessarily agree with that, because I don't believe that anybody has a truly, genuinely unencumbered, uninfluenced will. Even if you don't believe in God, you still don't have a free will, because you are still so influenced by your society, by your upbringing, by advertising, by the country that you were raised in. There are so many externals constantly feeding you ideas, thoughts, and opinions that you are always going to react based on the things that you have been fed. Therefore, there is no such thing as a genuinely, truly unencumbered, free will. But human beings want to argue that they have a free will. Okay, now the freest man who ever lived, the freest will of a human being short of Christ, the freest will we can find anywhere in the Bible would be Adam, I think I could argue. That Adam was the only person who at least had the freedom of conscience that he had never done anything wrong. He had no consciousness of sin. He had no shame about he and his wife and their nakedness. So he had at least the freest will of any human who ever lived. And what did he use his free will, quote unquote, to do? To rebel, to take the fruit that God said don't take. Yeah. So he took the one thing God said don't and did it by his quote unquote free will. And this is a man who had no movies not to go to, who had no cigarettes not to smoke, who had no alcohol not to drink. There were no other women to mess around with. There were no, I mean, his choices were really limited in terms of rebellion. In fact, it was limited to one thing. Don't eat that. And yet people think that in the society in which we live now, that is absolutely rife with temptation, where everywhere you look, everywhere you turn, not only are you in a fallen condition, in a fallen state, not only do you have a proclivity towards sin and rebellion, not only is that your natural state, but then everywhere you look, everywhere you turn, you are bombarded with temptations and voices that are drawing you away from God, that are approaching you logically or philosophically or through entertainment or through music or through just bombarding you with sinfulness and depravity, and you think, in that environment, your quote-unquote free will is going to help you? Absolutely not. You have no ability at all to withstand the temptations of this life. Jesus took authority over sin and temptation. The only man who ever did it. The only man who could say, I always do those things that please my Father. If Wolfgang tried that, are we going to believe him? Try it, Wolf. See if anybody believes you. Walk around telling people randomly. George has known you for a while. Try to convince George that you always do everything that pleases God. Not going to work. It's not going to fly. Wolf didn't even try, George. He didn't even give it a shot. He didn't know. No, we know intrinsically that this isn't the way people are or the way people can talk. Jesus did. He talked that way. He acted that way. He lived that way because he has an authority we don't have. He had the ability to control his will and his behavior and bring it all into the authority of God and always do and think and perform those things that please the Father. In other words, I say all that to say, he's not like you and you're not like him. He is far, far superior to him and you are far, far inferior to him. Did I get that sentence right? He is far, far superior to you and you are far, far inferior to him. One of those is correct. Did I get my pronouns mixed up? I probably did.
But we meant what you knew.
Exactly. Exactly right. So, with all that as introduction, now let's read what Matthew said as he continues to show us the authority that Jesus exercised over every aspect of human life. Starting at verse 14 of Matthew 8, when Jesus had come to Peter's home, he saw Peter's mother-in-law lying sick in a bed with a fever. By the way, what does that tell you about Peter? Tells you Peter is married. Now, of course, this raises all kinds of controversy because Peter is supposedly the first pope. The Catholic Church claims to be able to reach through their succession of popes all the way back to Peter. And of course, popes and priests don't marry. And yet Peter, their supposed first pope, was married. You don't find a prohibition against marriage anywhere in the Bible. In fact, you find encouragement toward marriage in the Bible. Now, yes, Paul writes that if a man is single and decides to be single, if a woman's going to be single, that's fine. Devote yourself to the Lord, that's fine. But there is absolutely no prohibition against marriage, especially for ministers, especially for those who serve God. And so the fact that Peter is married shows that Jesus didn't object to having somebody around him that was a married man. He did not say, you're going to be an apostle of mine, you're going to follow me for the next 3.5 years, and you're going to carry my word out into the world, therefore you cannot be married. That prohibition doesn't exist. Peter was married. So Peter's mother-in-law is sick, laying in bed with a fever. He touched her hand, the fever left her, she arose, and she waited on him. What a simple sentence, but think about what happened there. What causes fever? A virus, an infection, anything like that. So Jesus just took complete authority over things on a microscopic level. He just took authority over viruses, germs, infection. And all it took was the authority of Jesus touching her hand. She was healed. Then what did she do? She got up and served him. Because people who know who he is and who know his authority and his power recognize that they should worship him and serve him. As we're going to see in a little while, when he comes upon the demoniac at the Gadarenes, they worship him, because even they, in their wretched state, recognize that he's the authority. He's the Lord from heaven. Get down on your face. And so once again, I'll draw the contrast. Demons know enough to worship him. Human beings, not so much. How ignorant are we? So he touched her hand. The fever left her. She arose and she waited on him. And when evening had come, they brought to him many who were demon-possessed, and he cast out the spirits with a word, and he healed all that were ill. Okay, now let's take a moment and talk about that, because all of the New Testament writers do this, and it would be easy to read past and not see the significance of it. The New Testament writers recognize the difference between sickness and demon possession. They're two different things. In many denominations, in many versions of Christianity in various different religions, but especially in Pentecostalism, it's very common for people to associate every sickness with a devil. Every sickness becomes a demon. I heard somebody say, that woman has the devil of talking too much. Well, no, she just talks a lot. It's not a devil. Not everything is a demon. He's got the demon of a cold virus. He has to expel that demon. Well, no, that's not a demon. Some people have a devil. We'll see it in the New Testament. Some people have a devil and they can't speak. Jesus drives out the devil and then they're free to speak. Some people just can't speak. There is a difference. Let me be really controversial here for a moment. In the arena of emotional or psychological problems, sickness, the church has a really, really bad track record, because the church has never been particularly good about differentiating between demonic activity and something like manic depression. Depression can be, and most often is, a chemical imbalance. You know, I was part of a church one time where there was a woman who, they found out, was taking, I forget, Zoloft or something. And so the whispering campaign began. Oh no, oh, she's taking Zoloft. Oh no. That means she has some sort of psychological problem. Oh, and if she just had more faith, that wouldn't be the case. At the very same time, there was a fellow in the congregation who had sugar diabetes. And he had been just recently diagnosed. And the church as a body was really encouraging him to take his shots and watch his diet and take care of his health. So one person had a chemical imbalance in their digestive system. The other had a chemical imbalance in their brain. They're both chemical imbalances, but the one with the chemical imbalance in their pancreas, that's okay. That's no big problem. The one with the chemical imbalance in their brain, that's a demon. See the difference? See how upsetting and confusing that is? Well, right after that happened, right after that particular event, there was a secondary sort of whispering campaign of other people who had psychological problems who immediately went underground in that church because their great fear was somebody would find out. And if somebody found out, they would also be pointed at or whispered about or ostracized. The church is meant to be sanctuary. The church is the body of believers who are sinners saved by grace, who are not gathering together to judge one another. We're not gathering together to point at each other and say, well, this is where you fail and this is where you fail. In fact, according to Paul, the ministry of Christianity is the ministry of reconciliation. We are calling men and women to be reconciled to their God. It's the purpose of the gospel. And the gospel is all about forgiveness. The gospel is all about reconciliation and healing. And yet, in far too many churches that I've dealt with through the years, they can forgive just about anything, and they can pray for you if you're sick with just about anything, but don't have any kind of emotional or psychological problem, because that's the place where it flips from you have a disease to you have a devil. Or you don't have enough faith, or you need to pray more, or you need to, okay, well, let me point out again that the New Testament writers were very clear in drawing a differentiation between sickness and demonic activity. Those are two different things. And we as the church have to be able to create an environment of such safety, such security, that people who are hurt, people who are really damaged, they need to be able to come to a place like this knowing that they're not going to be judged, they're going to be loved, they're going to be accepted. People are going to listen to them. People are going to care about their pain and not immediately point at them and say, that's your fault. Because most of the time, it's not their fault. But like I said last week, I can't think of anything more cruel than telling a person you're sick because you don't have enough faith. They get to a faith healer, they don't get healed, and then the faith healer says, that's your fault. You didn't have enough faith. Well, that's just cruelty. It is equally cruel to tell somebody who has an emotional problem that that's their fault. Because they just don't have enough faith, or they've got a demon, or they've got... It's bad enough that they already have an emotional problem, then you throw it on them, and you have a devil. Ah! How scary is that? And yet it happens all the time in churches all over the place. So we need to be wise, we need to be compassionate, we need to be cautious, and we need to be discerning. Devils and demons are real. Devils and demons exist. But not everything that goes wrong is a devil or a demon. I'm not looking for a devil behind every bush. Tom and I come out of a church in California where everything that went wrong, and I mean everything that went wrong, was a devil. We were constantly on the lookout for a devil. There was always a demon, to the degree where if the preacher was preaching and there was feedback in the PA, then the devil got in the PA. You know, it was, yeah, we chuckle about it now. But we were so scared. I mean, we were constantly living in this state of, don't let the devil get you. If you don't keep up your guard constantly, the devil's going to get you. I lived with that constant fear. And then, of course, the more I read the Bible and the more I dealt with human beings, the more I came to realize, no, you know what? Most people's problem is not the devil. Most people's problem is themselves. Most people are just really that sinful. Most of the things people do, the devil didn't make them do it. They just did it because... that's how depraved they are. So, I have belabored the point. Look at this verse. After Jesus healed a woman with a fever, then verse 16, they brought to him many who were demon-possessed. That's different. He cast out the spirits with a word and healed all that were sick. Those are two different things. Sometimes it's a demon, sometimes it's sickness. He had authority over both, But the church has to be wise and discerning enough to be able to tell the difference and not hurt people in the process. Verse 17. He did this in order that what was spoken through Isaiah the prophet might be fulfilled, saying, he himself took away our infirmities and carried away our diseases. That's from Isaiah 53. It's Isaiah 53:4 to be specific. One of the things that Jesus is predicted to do was carry away sickness, carry away disease. And that's exactly what he did to prove that he was the fulfillment of that Isaiah prophecy and that he had that kind of authority. Starting in verse 18 now, there's a couple of people who approach Jesus. Because if you've got somebody with this kind of power, he's naturally going to gather people to himself, some of whom are just kind of there because, well, it's an event. There's a guy healing people. The blind can see, the lame are walking. Let's hang out with him for a while. Every event that happens, there's always a group that kind of hangs on until the event passes. And so Jesus had to deal with some folks like that, and he had to tell them what it would really take to be a disciple, what it would really cost to follow him. This falls under the category of count the cost. Verse 18, now when Jesus saw a crowd around him, he gave orders to depart to the other side. And a certain scribe came and said to him, teacher, I will follow you wherever you go. Does that sound familiar? Sounds a lot like Peter. I'll never deny you. I'll go wherever you go. I'll stay up with you all night. Human beings love to make these kind of grandiose proclamations because really it says more about the person than it does about Christ himself. Look at me. I'll follow you no matter what you do, no matter where you go. I'm with you. And Jesus, look at this statement, says, foxes have holes or dens, and the birds of the air have nests. The Son of Man has nowhere to lay down his head. In other words, he's saying, it's going to be rough. You think just because I'm doing these miracles, do you think I'm going to give everybody a feather bed? What's your expectation here? Remember the things that he says to his apostles. You're going to go out and you're going to preach my word. You're going to spread my gospel and you're going to be hated by all men. And you're going to be martyred because you're not of this world. Therefore, the world hates you. When the hangers-on come in and go, I am in, this is a thing that's happening, I am into this thing, and then the thing gets difficult, that's when the hanger-oners fall off. And Jesus had to deal with the same thing. He didn't allow this guy to think, well, if I follow Jesus, it's all going to go easy. Instead, Jesus said, yeah, you're going to go wherever I go. Well, let me start with, I got nothing. So I'm not going to give you a nice place to hang out. Are you ready to sleep where I sleep? Go where I go? Do what I do? Then another, verse 21, and another of his disciples, this is a loose meaning of disciple, a follower, said to him, Lord, permit me first to go and bury my father. But Jesus said to him, you follow me, allow the dead to bury their own dead. That sounds like a very callous statement on the surface. What you need to know, a little bit about the culture that he's dealing with here. It was typical that when a grown man had a grown parent who was no longer able to take care of themselves, that the person would take care of their parent until they died. And they were obligated to that parent until the parent died and they buried them. This young man was probably not saying to Jesus, my dad just died, let me go bury him and I'll be right back. Because the requirement would have been if his dad died that day, he would be with his dad that day. Instead, what he's saying is, let me go back home until my father dies and I bury him. In other words, I would love to follow you, but I have these other obligations. I would love to follow you, but I'm busy right now. I got this other stuff I got to take care of. So let me get back to you. I really like what you're doing. The whole ministry thing, like it. Let me get back to you. I got something I got to take care of. And even though it sounds like a good thing, go home, take care of your father, stay with him till he dies, Jesus realizes that there is no time. Jesus is only on the planet for a number of years. And he realizes that it's very, very common for people with every good intention to say, oh, no, I'm in, and then go get busy with the stuff of the world. So he says directly to him, follow me. And that's a statement that Jesus makes a lot in the Gospels. You follow me. That is a one-for-one relationship, you and Christ. You follow Christ. At the end of the book of John, there's a conversation between Jesus and Peter, where Peter, after he had denied Jesus three times, Jesus returns to the planet after his crucifixion, after his resurrection, appears on the shore. Peter realizes, while they're out in the boat, that that is Jesus on the shore. After they pull in such a large load of fish, he realizes it is the Lord, and he jumps in the water, can't wait for the boat, and he gets to the shore to get to Jesus. And there's a conversation between them where Jesus three times restores Peter after Peter's three denials. And three times he says, do you love me more than these? Do you love me more than you love your brothers here? Because I have to have the priority. After Peter affirms it and they go through that conversation that ends up with Peter weeping, Jesus then tells Peter, you know, after all your bragging about you'll never leave me, you'll never forsake me and all that, let me tell you what the end is going to be for you. You're going to be bound up and you're going to be taken a place you don't want to go. And then John tells us parenthetically that Jesus was talking about the fact that Peter was going to be martyred. Peter looks at John, knowing that he himself is going to be martyred. He looks at John and says to Jesus, well, what about him? What are you going to do about him? Jesus says, and by the way, this is a brilliant phrase that I would like you all to tattoo to your memory and remember it, because we all engage in horizontal thinking. We all engage in looking at somebody else and go, well, what about him? What about her? What about, you know, I'm working hard, I'm following you, and that guy, he's kind of following you. He seems to be doing better than me. What about him? Jesus says to Peter, what is that to you? You follow me. Because the directive from Jesus is always, follow me. One for one, follow me. But what about him? Follow me. What about those people? Follow me. What about what you've done in history? What is that to you? You follow me. So over and over again, Jesus gives this directive, follow me. And that's what he does to this young man who says, let me go and bury my father. He says two important things. Number one, follow me. Give up everything right now. Walk away. Follow me. I'm what's important. Remember what I said, Jesus always places himself at the center of the religious universe. What you think of him decides your eternity. Follow me. Do it now. Don't double think it. Don't debate it. Follow me. I'm here right now. I'm the Lord of glory. I have the words of life. Follow me. And then that phrase, and let the dead bury their dead. In other words, I'm life. Follow me, you have life. And there's a whole world out there that is not following me, and they're dead. They don't know they're dead. They're the walking dead. They're the apparently living dead. And as they die off, they will bury each other. So let the dead bury their dead. You follow me. Look at the power, the authority of it. Who am I? Who do you think I am? I'm the Son of God on the planet, and you're going to give me excuses? No, follow me. Come with me right now. Let the dead bury their own dead. Verse 23 says, and when he got into the boat, his disciples followed him. I think that's Matthew's way of differentiating, that there were some who followed, there were some who didn't. There were some who were just there because, like after he fed the 5,000. There were some that followed him because he fed them. And Jesus called them out on it. Said, you're following me because I fed you. They're in it for what they get out of it. Jesus had no problem with calling people out and saying, don't play with this. Don't pretend at this. He got into the boat. His disciples followed him. And behold, there arose a great storm on the sea, so that the boat was covered by the waves. And he himself was so concerned and so worried about the storm and the waves that he went to sleep. Because he's not worried about anything. It's his creation. Mm-hmm. It's his planet. It's his nature. So they're in a storm. He's sleeping. They came to him and awoke him and said, save us, Lord. We are perishing. As if. I mean, really think about it. Who did they really think he was at this point? They've just seen him do these unbelievable, miraculous miracles. Do they really think that he's going to drown? Do they really think that with him in the boat, they're all going under? But that's just human beings. It doesn't matter. We perish. Help us. And he got up and said, I understand. Sure, it's windy. Oh, you guys, you just don't get it yet. It's okay. No, he rebuked them. Why are you afraid, O ye of little faith, says the King James. The NASB says, you men of little faith. In other words, why don't you believe yet? He's doing this on purpose. Do you think the one who's omniscient, do you think the one who's in control of all nature, do you think he knew when he got on the boat that there was a storm coming? Mm-hmm. Sure, but he got on the boat anyway. And he took his disciples across that sea. And then the storm came up, and he did not rebuke the storm until they panicked. He went to sleep, which, by the way, shows you his humanity. He was tired. He needed to rest. And the storm wasn't going to stop him. So he went to sleep in the bottom of the boat. They freak out. Don't you know we're perishing? Don't you care that we're all going to die? And so naturally, he rebukes them. I've been with you this long. You've seen these miracles, and you still don't have any confidence at all. Oh, ye of little faith. And he arose, and he rebuked the winds and the sea, and it became perfectly calm. Not slightly calm. Matthew took the time to say, it stopped completely. Wind, waves, rain, storm, all did whatever he said. That's authority. Now, if you got somebody who has that kind of authority, shouldn't you listen to him? If he has something to say to you, shouldn't you pay attention? If you have somebody with that kind of authority, shouldn't you follow him? Men who have no authority gain followers. Shouldn't you really follow tight onto Jesus? Shouldn't you really be paying attention? And if he says go, you better go. And if he says come, you better come. And if he says listen, you better listen. Because he has this kind of authority. He has this kind of power. And the men marveled, saying, what kind of man is this that even the winds and the sea obey him? That is a good question. What kind of man is this? Because there are no humans that have that kind of authority. Again, if you don't believe it, try it. Go yell at the wind for a while. Go out there and debate with the rain and see if you can make it change its mind. You can't. He can. So, of course, people would say, what kind of man is this? Let's go look at Mark's account. Let's go to Mark 4:36. Because Mark fills in a few blanks here. We'll start at verse 35. Now, interestingly, when Mark positions this story, he puts it right behind the parable of the mustard seed, which is about people having very little faith. In verse 35, he says, and on that day, when evening had come, Jesus said to them, let us go over to the other side. And leaving the multitude, they took him along with them, just as he was in the boat, and other boats were with him. And there arose a fierce gale of wind, and the waves were breaking over the boat, so much that the boat was already filling up. And he himself was in the stern, underneath, and he was asleep on a cushion. And they awoke him, and they said to him, "Teacher, don't you care that we are perishing?" Don't you care? We're all dying. Aren't you worried? Don't you care about us? Notice it was all about them. Don't you care about me? Verse 39, being aroused, he rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Quiet, be still." Three words. Hush, be still. Okay, now earlier I said you can go out and argue with the rain, or you can debate with the wind to see if you can make a change. See if you can do it with three words. Get out there and still a storm with three words. Because it's not about the words. He could have used any words. He could have used one word. He could have said stop, and it would have, because he's in charge, because he has that kind of authority. That's the point. And the wind died down, and it became perfectly calm. And he said to them, "Why are you afraid? How is it that you have no faith?" And they became very much afraid, and they said to one another, "Who then is this, that even the wind and the sea obey him?" So far, we've been told that sickness obeys him. He drives out devils and demons. They obey him. The sea, the wind, the waves, they obey him. Shouldn't you?
Yes.
Think about how truly, genuinely rebellious human beings are that they will not listen to him. There's never been another person on the planet with that kind of authority. But to this day, people will argue and debate with what he has said as if they're on equal standing with him and as if they have the authority to debate what he has said. What kind of ego is that? Well, let's try it this way. There's a certain political correctness going on in our society right now. Well, you're not allowed to say certain things or debate with certain people. Certain people, if they say something, then that's just supposed to be the end of it. Just the end of it. You're not allowed to debate it. It's been said, it's been settled, it's done, that's it. Don't argue. And we'll kind of go along with it. Okay, well, I guess that's a settled issue. We don't get to argue with that. There are so many examples of it. Things that are happening in our society right now that we disagree with. But, well, we just go along with it because, well, what are you going to do? You know? Well, that's a settled issue. That's done. Yet those same people who say, well, these things are just settled, there's no argument, you bring up Jesus, they'll argue with you tooth and nail. Mm-hmm. Argue vehemently. When it comes to man-made ideas, man-made politics and policies, people go, well, I guess that's the way it is. I'll just go along with it. But when Jesus speaks, suddenly people think, I have all the authority in the world now. I can argue with every aspect of every word that Jesus ever said. And I'll decide for myself whether I buy it or not. The hubris of human beings who are willing to argue with Christ astounds me. Back to Matthew 8. Back to Matthew 8. We're going to start at verse 28. When he had come to the other side into the country of the Gadarenes, two men who were demon-possessed met him as they were coming out of the tombs. Now, what you need to know is that this area is part of the Decapolis. This is a Gentile area. There was a large Jewish population in the area, but it's a Gentile area. And the description of these tombs is that the tombs themselves are filthy tombs. This is a place that apparently has a history of evil activity, demonic activity. And Jesus, who would know that, goes there. Notice they didn't come find him. He went to where the seat of evil was in that area. Why? Because he has all the authority. He goes where he wants. He does what he wants. There were two demon-possessed men who were coming out of the tombs. And they were so exceedingly violent that no one could pass by that road. And behold, they cried out saying, this is a fascinating verse, read this. They said, what do we have to do with you, Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time? Well, that's just fascinating. Because these demons knew, number one, that he's the Son of God. You would think that that sort of accentuated evil, that sort of spiritual depth of evil, you would think that that would be where the argument was about Jesus' authority or godship. No, only humans argue that. Demons recognize him for who he is and call him Son of God, and then recognize that he's the one that's going to judge them and put them into the abyss. They recognize him as being the judge of the universe with whom they have to deal, and they're amazed to see him on the planet. They're not surprised they're on the planet. They've been cast out of heaven. They're going around trying to find hosts here on the planet. They're busy indwelling people and causing all kinds of damage. When the Son of God appears on the planet and they say, what are you doing here? What have you to do with us? And have you come to torment us, which shows you that the demons will ultimately be punished and tormented, and have you come to do it before the time? So they know there's a time schedule. They know there's a moment in time when he, the judge, will judge in righteousness, and they will fall under his judgment and fall into punishment and torment. They know all that. Ask most people, is judgment real? No, my God would never be like that. He would never do that. No, my God loves me. My God thinks I'm funny. My God would never be like it. Your God's a monster. Your God that torments people, your God that judges, your God. No, the demons know he's the Son of God and he's the judge. Human beings debate that. What do you have to do with us, Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time? Now there was, at a distance from them, a herd of swine feeding. The demons began to entreat him, saying, if you're going to cast us out, notice they don't debate his authority to cast them out. If you're going to cast us out, send us into the herd of swine. They need a host. They need to indwell somewhere. They're willing to take pigs. Notice, by the way, that they do not have the authority to take pigs without Jesus agreeing to it. Because he's there and he's in charge, they realize that he can judge them, he can torment them, he can cast them into the abyss, or he can let them have the pigs. It's all up to him. They put all authority in him. Whatever you want, they entreat him. That means they beg him, let us have the pigs, okay? Even demons know that Jesus is in charge. Humans, not so much. Let us have the herd of swine. He said to them, be gone. And they came out, and they went into the swine, and behold, the whole herd rushed down the steep bank into the sea and perished in the waters. Now, I know it's a caustic thing to say, but whenever I read that, I think, so there were these demoniacs that were willing to live and walk around with demons inside them. The pigs weren't having it. The pigs into the sea drowned themselves. But human beings walking around full of demons. Human beings are so corrupt, so depraved. So, naturally, the townspeople came out and were very excited to have someone with this kind of authority in their midst. No. What do they see? They see, hey, our pigs are dead. Hey, you killed our pigs. That's my money. That's how I make my living. You just wrecked my living by killing my pigs. Will you please leave? There's the depravity of human beings. The demons see him and worship him. Human beings see him and go, could you leave, please? Could you get out of here? That's what happens. And the herdsman ran away, went into the city, reported everything, including the incident of the demoniacs, and behold, the whole city came out to meet Jesus, and when they saw him, they entreated him to depart from their region. Can you please go away? You're wrecking my economy here. I'm not enjoying having you here. Can you please go? Now let's turn over for just a moment and read Luke's account of this, because Luke again fills in some blanks. Now let's read Mark's account. We won't read them both, because both Mark and Luke also recount this same thing. Turn to Mark 5. Let's do that. And then we'll be done for the morning. Mark 5. Now, the first thing you're going to notice, and this is something that the critics of the Bible try to make a great deal of, is the fact that when Matthew tells the story, he says there are two demoniacs. When both Mark and Luke tell the story, they talk about one man. And so there are a couple of different commentaries that attempt to harmonize what looks like a contradiction between the two tales. But it's not difficult to harmonize, because what you're going to see at the end of both Mark and Luke's story that you don't see at the end of Matthew's story is that one of the men actually sits at Jesus' feet in his right mind. And so Luke and Mark concentrate on that guy. The other one, apparently, after being healed, either goes on about his evil ways or goes back. We hear nothing more about him. And so I think the way to harmonize the apparent difference is that there were two men that were demonically possessed. And Jesus did come take authority over them, and one of them recognized who Jesus was and served him, followed him, which is exactly what Mark and Luke tell us about. And they don't tell us anything about the other guy, so I think they both concentrated on the one who actually worships Christ. So let's start at chapter 5, verse 1. They came to the other side of the sea, into the country of the Gerasenes, same word as the Gadarenes. And when he had come out of the boat, immediately a man ran from the tombs with an unclean spirit and met him, and he had his dwelling among the tombs, and no one was able to bind him anymore, even with a chain, because he had often been bound with shackles and chains, and the chains had been torn apart by him, and the shackles were broken into pieces, and no one was strong enough to subdue him. This is a dangerous guy and a powerful demon. Chains and shackles can't hold him. And constantly, night and day, among the tombs and in the mountains, he was crying out and gashing himself with stones. Which tells you, by the way, that the demons then that possessed him were destructive demons, which would help you understand why the pigs would kill themselves once this kind of destructive demon was inside them. So verse 6, seeing Jesus from a distance, he ran up and bowed down before him. Now in Luke's account of it, rather than using the word bowed down, he says, and he worshiped. The demons worshiped Christ because they knew who he was. The demons had a clearer recognition and understanding of who Jesus is than most people have. Crying out with a loud voice, they said, what do I have to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High? I implore you by God, do not torment me. For he had been saying to him, come out of the man, you unclean spirit. And he said to him, what is your name? The demon said to Jesus, my name is Legion, for we are many. Okay, so how many soldiers are in a Roman legion?
5,000.
5,000! This guy's walking around on the planet. 5,000! And they're willing to brag about it. Let's just call ourselves Legion. I mean, that's how many we are. That's good enough. My name is Legion, for we are many. And he began to entreat him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now, we don't have time to go into this. We talked about it a little bit in our systematic theology series when we talked about demonology. But one of the things that Jesus explained is that when the amateur exorcists of the Jews were driving out demons, because they didn't have the ability to set up housekeeping inside the person who had been swept clean, that what the demon would do is go to an arid place, which was torturous to him. He would find other demons worse than himself. I think 7 was the number. And he would find other demons worse than himself and say, let's go back to where I came from, because it's swept clean, wide open, and the end of that man was worse than the beginning. The point Jesus was making was he had the authority not only to drive out demons, but then to inhabit people in such a way that the demons could no longer take that person. That's the kind of authority that Jesus has that human exorcists simply don't have. And so this idea of being driven out of their host and into an arid place was torturous to demons, which is why they said, don't send us out of him and out of the country, because they would end up in the deserts wandering, tortured, looking for a host. Now there was a big herd of swine feeding there on the mountain, and the demons entreated him, saying, send us into the swine so that we may enter them. And he gave them permission, because it's all up to him. And coming out, the unclean spirits entered the swine, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the sea, about 2,000 of them, and they were drowned in the sea. Well, now you can see why legion would be a good number. There would have to be thousands of demons to take thousands of swine. He gave them permission. Verse 14, their herdsmen ran away and reported it in the city and out in the country, and the people came to see what it was that had happened. And they came to Jesus and observed the man who had been demon-possessed, look at the description, sitting down, clothed, and in his right mind. The very man who had had the legion, and they became frightened. And those who had seen it described to them how it had happened to the demon-possessed man and all about the swine, and they began to entreat him to depart from their region. And as he was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed was entreating him that he might accompany him. And he did not let them, but he said to him, go home to your people, report to them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he has mercy on you. And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis what great things Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled. The sad part about 2,000 years of human history, I think, is that we have lost our sense of marvel. Yeah. We have lost our sense of how truly marvelous Christ is. We have lost our sense of the astounding authority that he exercises and still exercises to this moment. He is right now seated at the right hand of God, and all authority in heaven and earth is given to him. He is the one that will sit on the white throne and will judge the quick and the dead. He's the one that's in control of everybody who's born and everybody who dies. He is the sovereign. He's in majesty. He is sitting at the right hand of God. He is also encased in that light that no man approaches. He is the Son of God. And we have lost the ability to marvel at that. We've become used to it. We've become accustomed to it. So much so that people will use his name like it's a cuss word. So much so that people will say Jesus like it's an exclamation, because they have forgotten what they're dealing with. They have forgotten who they're dealing with. And human beings, in their rebellion, in their sinfulness, in their depravity, won't give him the same awe, respect, and honor that even the demons give him. How corrupt are humans? So, all of nature obeys him. Sickness, disease obeys him. Demons obey him. During his 3 days and nights when he's in the belly of the earth, he goes down into Abraham's bosom. He goes to where the souls of the dead are and takes his own like a great company and takes them to their heavenly estate to be with him. That's the kind of authority that he has. The gates of hell will not prevail against it. That's his church. So he has that kind of astounding, overwhelming, unending, and infinite power and authority, and he exercises that authority constantly everywhere. The only reason the planets are not crashing into each other is because he's exercising his authority. The only reason you know your name is because he's exercising his authority. The only reason that you're not dead yet is because he's exercising his authority. The only reason that you will end up in his presence and be accepted by God and live eternally in bliss and happiness is because he's exercising his authority. The only reason that some sinful, depraved people are chosen since before the foundation of the world in order to be trophies of grace that will be a testimony through all of eternity to him is because he is exercising his authority. So, I said all that to say, follow him.
Amen.
You got it?
Yes, sir.
Follow him. He knows what he's doing. And the world will come at you with their philosophy and with their naysaying and with their ignorance and with their arguments. But until they can stop the wind, they got nothing. The one who has all the authority is the one you need to listen to.
Thank you for listening to this Sunday morning message from Grace Christian Assembly. Please visit our website at salvationbygrace.org. And join us next time as we gather around the Word and study God's sovereign grace.